first two conversations with Eric laid out the values of wraparound and the system conditions that enable those values to operate. Our final conversation turns to wraparound's moral center, unconditional care. Unconditional care does not mean every service continues forever or that practitioners set aside safety boundaries or evidence. It means that the system does not withdraw belonging and responsibility just because a child or family is hard to serve. When the plan fails, the plan changes. The young person is not defined as the failure. This distinction matters because many systems are built around eligibility, placement, and discharge, and a young person with the most complex needs can cycle through program after program precisely because each one is designed to remove someone once the fit gets difficult. Wraparound asked the team to stay engaged, learn from setbacks, and to use relationships and natural supports to provide continuity across changing services and circumstances. Eric connects this persistence to trust. Families and youth who have been repeatedly let down have good reason to doubt new promises. Trust begins when a team does what it said it would do, stays transparent, and keeps showing up after a crisis or disappointment. Unconditional care in that sense is not a sentiment. It is a pattern of behavior. As you listen, consider the difference between saying, "This child does not fit our program," and asking, "What would we have to change, add, or coordinate so this child can belong and make progress?" That shift is small in language and enormous in practice. So let me take us back from AI and talk a little more about some of the underlying principles of wraparound that were articulated early by some of the progenitors. Let's go back to some of the progenitors like Carl Dennis and John Vander. When I first studied Carl's work, what I learned from him and observing was why it was important to him to sit on the admissions committee to make sure that Kaleidoscope, the organization that he was running, took the hardest children, never creamed, and at the same time, John's deep commitment to no eject as well as no reject. And I've actually saw examples later on of young people who under other conditions would have been X'd out, who just had plans redeveloped so that they could ultimately succeed. Would you talk about the importance of unconditional care, knowing at the same time the challenges to enable that to happen, given conditional affordances and systems?
Yeah, I think that leadership that reflects Carl's world. Carl passed last year, and he was just a giant in our field. To your point, when we were trying to come up with the 10 principles of wraparound, he would say, "Well, the 10 principles of wraparound are never give up and never give up." That really was, he just said, "We don't even call Kaleidoscope wraparound. We just call it unconditional care. Do whatever it takes." Right? Now, that's easy to say because then you have to have all those conditions in place if you truly want to make that happen at scale. If you just have one organization that serves 10 or 20 families and you have Carl Dennis at the head, and it's the 70s or 80s when folks were a little looser around their accountability and accounting rules, you could probably just get away with having Carl Dennis leading the team, right? In this day and age, you've got to have those things explicitly in your protocols, your standards of practice, your memorandum of agreement. We had a state that will remain nameless where we were doing fidelity reviews. And one of the reviews we did right off in the first week or two, we saw a piece of documentation that said that the family was disenrolled in wraparound because they went out of the country during the engagement process. And the rules were that you couldn't leave the country for more than 2 weeks. If you were, you would just be disenrolled because you were disrupting the process. And even my staff, the junior research assistants, were like, I just came across this. Is this really something that is allowed to happen given what taught me about wraparound? We had to go all the way to the state with this. And they said that there was misinterpretation of the rules, but there was a rule in there that literally said if you don't show up or if you're not available, then we'll disenroll you. And that's just madness. If you really if you don't want to do wraparound, don't call it wraparound. But first and foremost, those are the kinds of things that have to be just emblazoned in every level, at every in every piece of guidance that there is that we do not give up on families. You strip all of those kinds of rules out and you make it about, again, families don't fail, plans fail. It turned out that family was going back to Mexico because their family had a giant Independence Day celebration and they were going for a family reunion. And this is a strength that could have been built upon, and instead they disenrolled them. It was just so this is an uphill battle, just like the natural supports, or just like being able to give care coordinators a blank checkbook to buy after school programming or summer camps or lacrosse league or whatever. And it's very frustrating, David.
That if I want to use something else I learned from Carl, and again to invite you to comment on it. And by the way, let me add that this it, to people listening, it there's good reason to be frustrated. This has been a problem in the better of times. In times that are nastier, it can become even a greater problem. But we have to keep listening to Carl Dennis, which I think Eric and you and your team do, which is keep trying and not go away. But one of the other things that I learned from Carl, and you, again, please tell me if I mislearned it, is it's only when you have a commitment to zero eject that you really have to find strengths. Because as long as you can pass that kid off to somebody else, you don't have to really look for the strengths. But if it's only that kid and me, and I still remember that moment when Trina, my wife Trina, and I, who were in, Trina worked with the Wraparound Initiative, and we're very much into strength-based training. We were seeing for the first time Apollo 13, and there's the moment where someone comes into the room and says, "He is all we have, get him home." And we both reached up to each other in our seats and said, "Strengths-based."
Yep.
That's what I think Carl was also saying, and that's what we need to do as we're moving forward. But I invite the comment, not this is not a
Well,
speech.
that's a new one. I think it makes total sense. That's the kind of thing that Carl would espouse. We've heard a lot about his absolute commitment. I just would trust anything that Carl says. And if he says that at an organizational level, starting with unconditional care, never give up. People don't fail, plans fail. We're going to keep revising the plan. We're going to keep sticking at it no matter what. If that family, we, but so I believe that is probably true. If you have any kind of ability to eject a youth who is causing your organization problems and you don't have that principle first and foremost, then sure, you're going to be a lot less likely to be looking at strengths first and a lot more likely to be looking at deficits, diagnoses, and so forth. So I if that's what Carl says is that's the where strengths based is most likely that is the condition that's most in need to be in place for true strengths based planning to happen. I believe it. We've got I think that strengths based is a very hard narrative, a very hard frame shift to encourage even among the best provider organizations. If you have a system that truly says you are we are going to support you to do whatever it takes by giving you those case rates, those capitated rates that allow you to do whatever it takes to have flexible funds, right, to be held accountable to outcomes at a population level rather than any one individual kid is going to bring the hammer down on you if something bad happens. If you've got a supportive system that truly believes in unconditional care and leaders who have the principles at their heart, then I think you can make strengths-based happen. And I think that's probably what Carl was reflecting on.
And I think where some listeners who work in the education space may see this best is in how schools tend to use exclusionary discipline. Kids of color or for kids with disabilities, when the notion is if we just get rid of that rotten apple, everything is going to be fine, when lo and behold, the problem never gets fixed. And in reality, what we have is the canary in the coal mine who is responding to the problems of an environment. And if we really create conditions for that young person, we may actually create conditions that benefit others.
Yeah, schools. I'm not an educator, but I hang around with a lot of folks who are just incredible thinkers and doers around inclusive education environments and what does it take to select and implement policies and programs that assure that inclusionary practices happen. I have so many friends who are school teachers, including special educators, and man, that is such an incredibly difficult policy and practice line to walk when you're talking about changing the culture of a school to be inclusive. But I think that the parallels between that and lessons that can be learned between the systems of care slash wraparound and then education environments, there's got to be some great cross-learning that we could do there. No expert in those school-based practices that get to the vision of an inclusive environment for all learners, but we know that it can be done. And a lot of and what I from what I've learned from my colleagues who dwell in that space, once again, there's so much about it that is that layers of the onion with accountability and data at the core of it all, right? Like, how many of our students right now are experiencing those kinds of outcomes? What were the conditions that made those ejects happen, right? Those pulling out of these students, the discipline, the expulsions and suspensions and so forth, and digging in and saying, we're just going to have a culture of improvement and a team of folks who are going to come together, just like a wraparound team around our school to say, what are the strategies we need to do to get better at this rate of exclusionary discipline or disproportionality by race or ethnicity. What are we gonna, what's our best thinking, pulling from all the evidence-based practices as well as our local community and all of the smart people here? What's our best thinking about a better set of strategies?
No, I think, and Eric, I think as we, before we go back to wraparound, I think your point about cross-system learning at even that meta level is really important and correct. You know, that when with others, I wrote a book in 2002 first for SAMHSA, and then it came out in 2004 as a published book, Safe, Supportive, Successful School Step by Step. Its subtext was coming from my work in special education and mental health. And it really was how one could create a school-wide wraparound process that was individualized, and at the same time, how we do it. I didn't label it in that way, in the same way that I did not use the label that SAMHSA wanted for the book, which was bringing mental health into the schools, because I thought it would be something that was the kiss of death for a book. But
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
ultimately, I think support services, mental health services can learn a great deal from what good school work is doing, and at the same time, vice versa. And we need people to come together and learn from each other where they can, and wrap around and systems that support wraparound are ideal for that, because of the fact that education has to be a player, and education needs mental health and child welfare as players, or they're not in the game.
Absolutely. Mental health, quote unquote. Schools are the number one place that we need to invest in at a population level to try and improve all kids' mental health, right? Across all of the tiers, right? It's going to be the place where kids are going to learn social emotional skills, where they're going to develop social competencies. If a kid is struggling, it's going to be the place where they're most likely to be identified and get help early if you have good screening and so forth, right? That's just inherent to good education. Is to have systems in place that are going to have the most positive learning environment, behavior that's really going to happening in the school, in each classroom, that's going to allow each student to learn, each teacher to feel like they're effective, right? It's not about bringing mental health into schools. It's just about creating, like you say, safe, supportive environments for learning. So I'm with you on that 100%. But it's just similar to the whole conversation we're having about systems of care and wraparound. It all flows down from the systems level policies, workforce development and support, multi-stakeholder engagement. You need to have community school teams that are, again, asking, what can we do better? How are we doing now? What's our strengths? What's our needs for improvement? Good leadership, good data to help guide how well you're doing. It's all the same, but and yet it's all education's a totally different game at the same time, and yet the same kind of lessons about how much systems and programs, in this case, school buildings, affect each individual kiddo. It's all the parallels are there for sure.
As we move towards concluding our conversation, I'd like to take your practically focused conversation and make it even more actionable. So let's start with what someone can observe when they're just hanging around and walking around, and if one has the opportunity to listen to a team supporting a young person. What are the indicators that you have really good, powerful work going on as opposed to something that may be adequate, but it's never going to really move the nickel or the
Yeah.
dime?
Oh my gosh. Researchers are very famous for overbuilding their measures, right? So we have measures of fidelity and quality for wraparound implementation or anything else that we get involved in that have got so many indicators, right? But I think that I would start by just talking to the individuals who have the hardest job in, at least in wraparound care coordination. It's the care coordinators themselves, right? If you go into an organization and folks who genuinely like young people and genuinely have a sense that they have a chance to really improve families who have, again, been just like trodden upon by life, the system, our country's environmental context and politics. We've got so many families struggling and their kids are expressing it. You go into a wraparound organization and people who are just actually energized and able to engage in that work from a place of those principles, right? If you have folks who are actually working with these young people who, if you say, tell me about the toughest kid you ever worked with or the toughest family, and tell me and describe them only in terms of their strengths. And their eyes light up and they start telling a story or two that is in that kind of a way where they are showing that they personally have that inherent ability to shift the frame from deficits to strengths and needs as being the basis for planning. Then you know something good is happening. And it probably is reflective not just of that person, but their supervisor. And that supervisor's leader and the person running that organization and the system that they're working in. I go into different wraparound serving organizations, and just like so many things, it's unfortunate where backsliding is a lot more virtual kind of work as opposed to people coming together and sharing and having a camaraderie. But that stuff still does exist, and you can feel that sense of mission and that sense of holding the values close at heart in some places. And all of the measures in the world, they'll probably correlate with that, but it's a lot of work to collect all that fidelity and outcomes data when really you could probably just go from one organization to another or one state to another and say, do you get what you need to make families' lives better? And you see some folks being like, oh my gosh, I love this job. It's really hard, but I've got supportive folks. They let me take breaks. I work flexible hours. I can get families the things they need. And then you go to another one and you just see people being like, I'm just in this job until I get a different one because I needed a job. That's just that you can sense it. And we could make that first version happen in a lot of places more than does now if we really wanted to work hard and make that happen. It doesn't have to be the exception. It doesn't have to be, like Pat Miles said, an accident of good social work when care coordinators and other helpers actually have that attitude and have that sense that the system has their back to help families.
That's right. In episode 7, we will be listening to, among other places, people from Cleveland and the UCLA Community School, where people will hear about what happens when you have leaders who are doing that and where you have the affordances again for people to ultimately feel that they can do their work. They're not just pushing a chair on the Titanic. Let me ask about listening to consumers. Let me start with a story. I first met Carl again because I, through a research process, I had identified Kaleidoscope as one of the places that I ought to learn about and document. And I asked Carl to enable me to speak to some of the consumers, in this case, family members he was dealing with. And I interviewed a gentleman who was a client while he was living on the streets with a woman who he ultimately married and gave birth to a child who was born addicted. And that's how they got into Kaleidoscope. And I said to this guy who had a pretty tough life in terms of services, as you said before, why do you trust these people? And I used exactly those words. And he said, because when they made an appointment, they kept it. Now, I want you to hold that in mind, and I guess the audience now as well. In 1999, with John Vandenberg and Kim Kinzora and Carl Dennis, we wrote an introduction to a special issue on resilience as a social process and not individual process. And I invited John and Carl to not just co-edit it, but write one piece for it. And the piece that came from Wraparound was about a person, a mother, who did not show up for a meeting with the counselors. So they rescheduled it, and the mother did not show up again. So they rescheduled it and maybe did one or two other things, and the mother did not show up a third time, if I remember correctly. And they rescheduled it, and the mother showed up. And things happened. And I think the combination of how one creates systems that enable a gentleman like the man who is living on the streets to experience relational trust with professionals who show up and not punish that same person if his life gets in the way so that he can't show up is the essence of a system that then can support wraparound. And again, I want to invite you to critique that or riff on it.
There's not much more to riff on. That's unconditional care, right? Is never giving up, but also as you were hinting at, there was probably some creativity inherent there too, right? What is the barrier that was being experienced? Is it a barrier, like you say, having to do with that person's life circumstances being really challenging? Their transportation was a problem, or their need to report to work that was not flexible, right? So is it a tangible barrier, and what can we do to address that? Do we need to meet you somewhere else? Do we need to maybe come to where you are, find a way to meet with you at your job, or creative problem solving at that level? Or is it something that has to do, like you was being suggested, with that trust question, or that experience, past experiences with systems that make that person really feel as though, I've been down this road before, I've been blamed and I've been shamed when I've gone to appointments. Why would I do that again? That would be a different kind of set of creative solutions that you would need to then put in place for the second or third attempt at that meeting, right? And again, it's that kind of fundamental first commitment to whatever it takes. And then on top of that, having the space, the resources, the flexibility, the organizational commitment to creative problem solving around what that little interaction is, that or that tweak to the process of just rescheduling that would be needed to get that interaction held, right? And again, it all comes back to whether or not you've got folks who hold the principles, but they also are working in a context where they're rewarded for using their resources creatively and not just under the constraints of the system, unable to color outside the box, to go meet someone after hours, to go to the community and meet them, to have there be a first, we're just going to have a 5-minute meeting. Sure, we have to do this whole intake interview in order to get paid to work with you, but if the first thing that would help is just 5 minutes, that's all we need. Just give me 5 minutes. And again, it's just whatever it takes.
A last question, and I want you to think now about both a care coordinator in some place in the country right now who could learn from this conversation and even be more impactful in what they do, and also somebody who supports and is responsible for the results. And I'm using that word not because it's the word I would like to use, but it's the word that systems would use for of what that care coordinator does. What are things that they could be doing immediately, knowing that everybody's space is different? But what are the things that they could think about asking and doing?
Yeah, I think that there are little things that somehow don't get done very often that are really important for engagement, for problem solving, for accountability. One of them is just make sure that you're planning, you're doing your plans around just one deep need in the family's own words, right? Really open, as Carl would say, I think that Carl would say this, you gotta empty your mind and open your ears and just listen, right? And if you really take time to listen, as opposed to feeling like you're compelled by your own accountability or your own productivity or your own schedule, and you really, and I struggle with this myself, I like to talk, right? But you got to find ways to just listen. And people feel heard. They are much more likely to work with you as a helper and to think creatively with you about what a different life might look like, more likely to show up next time because they feel heard, right? So one thing I would just say is just gotta listen. And if you're feeling as though whatever the demands are you on your time are on you, do not allow you in your day-to-day work with families to spend a lot of time listening, then you need to exert a little upward accountability as well. And the other thing is, again, if you listen that carefully and frequently and consistently, you're going to hear things that make wraparound happen that apparently are hard, which is you're going to hear about stories about people who have helped the family in the past that you might want to ask, how do we get that person involved in your life now? You're going to hear the story from the heart, the hole in the heart that's underlying the big behaviors of the kiddo or the things that are getting in the way of the family following through on things, right? And that would be a second thing is, again, listening opens up opportunities for other stuff that's so critical in the hello to help, to healing, to hope. Who are the people that might be part of this team with you? How would we describe what your deep need is that we're going to need to meet, that we want to meet here? How will we know that things are better, right? Too often we just feel like we have to check off the boxes. And those things that are part of wraparound don't happen if we don't just take time to listen and be curious and note those things and file them away for use when the time is going to be right to do so. Yeah, that's one thing.
Eric, that was wonderful. That was spot on. Thank you very much for gracing us with your time.
Thank you so much, David. It's great to hang out with you. This has been an amazing hour, and I really appreciate it.
There's a